All right, we are on PDC. We're at PDC 09, Channel 9 Live. And as you learned yesterday, we have people from JPL and NASA here. Today I have a very special guest. It turns out Mr. McQuiston runs the Mars program.
That's right.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do.
Yeah, well, I'm responsible for all the pieces of the program, both the missions that are operating and building the current missions that we launch, as well as the strategic development of the program, both the science that we're going to attack and working with the community and planning the future of the program and the budgets, of course.
Excellent. So Mars is really interesting. And so let's talk a little bit about the history of the program. I mean, when we looked up at the sky long ago, we thought, wow, I wonder what's going on there. Yeah.
Well, actually, there's two pieces here. I'll talk to you about the history of Mars, and I'll talk about the history of the program. Mars has been interesting because of the way its orbit works with Earth. As far back as 10,000 years or so ago, we know that ancient man actually looked at Mars differently. It was red compared to all the other stars in the sky that were white or clear or silver. And it made a very funny curlicue because of the way our two planets rotate around each other.
Interesting.
So it's been fascinating for a long time. It became very, very exciting in the late 19th century when a gentleman who's an astronomer named Schiaparelli thought he saw what he called canali. He was Italian, called it canali on the surface, which really in Italian it means lines. But people translated it to canals, and you know, the next thing you know, we've got Orson Welles and and H.G. Wells and everybody else. The program, actually, we flew some missions early. The globally, we did. The Russians have flown missions, and the Europeans have flown missions, and we flew missions back in the 60s. Really, Mars science became really, really exciting in the 70s when the Viking landers, the twin Viking landers, put down in the late 70s. Taught us a lot about Mars, and the current program actually began in around the year 2000, and it's the first time we've done a strategic build of missions to accomplish a specific scientific goal or theme. The current theme is to follow the water, to try to understand the history of water on the planet, because of the things you need for life, water is the one key we know that's common amongst all life forms, water and energy sources. So we're trying to understand the water cycle of the planet, whether what we thought were canali by Schiaparelli, what we know now are ancient riverbeds and ancient river deltas.
Certainly.
And lakes, and what the process of those water, the water was, and was it there long enough to allow life to develop and evolve?
Interesting. So there could have been oceans on Mars.
We believe there
were. Probably not. It certainly looks like it in the surface.
Yeah.
So I just want to point out, we have the director of the Mars mission from NASA. Please tweet some questions. Even if you're not an Earthling, you can still tweet at CH9Live. Go to twitter.com, ask some questions. I will continue with some questions that I have for you. And I think the best thing to talk about right off the bat is, what have we learned so far?
Well, we have, probably the most important is we've confirmed a very significant water history on the planet.
Okay.
The things, as I said, the things that we thought were canals a long time ago actually are. What's even more important is that there is a significant amount of water still on the planet in the form of ice.
Okay.
So there's a polar ice cap on the North Pole and on the South Pole. There's also a significant ice layer under the surface near the equator that we just discovered. We believe there's instances where some of that water may actually be making it to the surface periodically in some processes we don't quite understand yet.
Interesting.
So the activity of water on the planet is drastically broader and greater and probably longer lived than we ever thought it was.
Wow, that is just amazing. So light bulb, all right. Everybody knows light bulb. Light bulb has a question for you. Do we know if there are natural resources like minerals or oil on Mars?
That's an excellent question. Minerals, absolutely. Both from orbiter missions that we actually have an instrument called CRISM on a mission called the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter that has 544 channels on it, can actually look at different minerals on the surface from its orbit.
Okay.
And of course, Spirit and Opportunity are on the ground. And Phoenix was, well, Phoenix is still on the ground, even though we don't think it's alive any longer, up in the northern polar region.
Sure.
Froze to death over the winter.
Okay.
But the minerals that we have found are very common minerals that we see on Earth. Sulfates, phyllosilicates, which is a fancy term for clay, and other basaltic minerals, irons, and things like that. Oil is a very interesting question, because where petroleum comes from on Earth is from decaying life forms, right? Don't know about that one yet.
Blood of the dinosaur.
Exactly. So if we found oil, it would be a spectacular discovery in relation to life off this planet.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. So, you know, let's just come out and ask, could there be life on Mars today, given, you know, what we've learned? I mean, how would you rationalize presenting an answer to that question?
Well, Charles, actually, I personally believe that there either is or has been. And I think the scientific evidence is headed that way as well. The amount of water on the surface, we've found some interesting things recently, like methane. Back in 2003, some observations were made, and this went public about 2 years ago, where we have found that there is a large volume of methane that is both seasonal on Mars and regional on Mars. There's only two ways to produce methane. One is geologically, which is interaction between certain types of rocks and heating processes that probably are based volcanically that can produce methane. The other is biogenic, right? Everybody thinks about it, the cow in your backyard that produces methane.
Yeah.
Right. So something's happening. One of two things. Either we have a much more geologically active planet than we thought with Mars, or we've got a biogenic source of methane. So our intent is to go validate not just the content of the methane, in other words, the density of the methane, but the location and the frequency of it as we thought we found in 2003. We're going to do that in the 2016 timeframe. We're working on a mission right now that will go actually identify that and help us understand what the sources of it are, and maybe even localize it so that when we go to the surface afterwards, we can find it.
I mean, that's a great point, because on Earth, on planet Earth, which is clearly lots of life here, the most dominant form of life is microbial.
Absolutely.
I mean, the microbes dominate the surface of this planet.
That's right.
So in some sense, and they're also the things that produce the methane inside the cow, right?
That is true.
To some degree. So in some sense, what you could be seeing with methane, because when the methane goes into the atmosphere, it disappears quickly, something puts it in, it goes away, it comes back in, you know something's putting it in.
Right.
That could be really, really interesting.
It could.
That's phenomenal.
It could. And so also, as far as life on Mars now or in the past, as I said earlier, we know the water processes were there.
Amazing.
The atmosphere, we believe, was heavier in the distant past. We believe it was more Earth-like, you know, 3.5 to 4.5 billion years ago.
Wow.
And all the things are there that support life as we understand it. So the question is it there or was it there?
Awesome. And so I have a lot of other questions, but you know what? This is about you. And thank you for tweeting CH9Live, at CH9Live, twitter.com. Tweet some questions. Crypto Argonaut, you're back. I remember you from yesterday. Can you explain how the rovers lasted 6 years instead of just 90 days?
That's actually a great question. I've asked some of my engineers that every once in a while. Hey, how did we do that?
Yeah.
So, part of Mars is that we don't understand it very well. There's a lot to explore. When you think about the fact that you can walk faster than these rovers drive. A good driving day for a rover is about 100 yards. Right, that's a long day. Right, you can do that in a couple of minutes. Right, walk the football field.
Yeah.
So we're still learning a lot about Mars. So we engineered those rovers based on what we thought we would find out. One of the main things was we expected the dust in the atmosphere to be so severe that it would settle on the solar rays, and eventually, very quickly, actually, that the dust buildup would be such that we didn't get enough sunlight to keep the batteries charged and they would die.
Okay.
That was part of the 90 days.
Sure.
We didn't know that there were a thing called dust devils, which are little atmospheric tornadoes, if you will, that run across the surface of Mars and have cleaned those arrays off a number of times.
That is amazing.
The dust levels are lower than we thought, and so a lot of the motors and mechanisms actually have survived better than we expected them to because they aren't being worn as severely. So,
absolutely.
So it's a confluence of very fortunate events.
And it's interesting, because in the conversation we had with your colleague yesterday, who's at JPL doing a lot of the engineering kind of things, he mentioned that dust devils were very interesting.
They are.
And of course, I didn't ask him why, which would have been the obvious question, but now you just answered it. So put the pieces together. So, G. Chavez, how do you think that the web technology can help find new forms of life?
Actually, that's a very good question. I think that And it goes back to the conference that we're sitting at, I think, and some of the work that Microsoft and NASA are doing in the realm of citizen scientists and making this kind of data available to people. The more people that look at these things, it's not just your PhD scientists that can really recognize, use their human intuition, their human curiosity, identify interesting things.
Sure.
One example, there's a type of lichen that lives in the desert. On Earth. And if you took a rock and you turned it over and you looked at it, you would think it would be kind of just a white, dusty, lumpy portion of the rock. But in fact, it's alive.
Mm.
And if you don't know what you're looking at, or you don't have the curiosity to say, hey, what is that?
Yeah.
You may not realize that you're looking at a form of life, right? That same thing, by providing more and more data to people, and that access is through these web technologies, you can get more and more people looking at this data, thinking about the data, asking questions about the data, and feeding that information back to NASA and to the science community, universities, if they're in college, to their professors. So I think the web technologies are going to revolutionize how we look at science data, actually.
Excellent. So this is, I love the notion of citizen science. We have Adam Hill asking, you have partnered with Azure and used Dallas to make Mars imagery available. Who do we bug at NASA to get other data sets opened up?
That's a good question. Well, since I guess it's me, since I'm in charge of the program, we have a data user group, and we have a planetary science data system where all of our data goes. So we have that on record, and I actually will ask that question and take it back and see if we can pursue this. Not to continue to plug what we're doing together with Microsoft, but I think it's very interesting.
It is, actually.
And exciting. That's another way to do this, is to expand the demand for the data, just like he asked, and help us open some of that data set up.
Perfect. So we have Offbeat Mammal. That name sounds familiar. If Mars is smaller than Earth, how come Mars has larger volcanoes than Lightbulb says, and deeper canyons?
Yeah. This is one of the exciting mysteries of the universe and of the solar system. I'm not sure that we know the answer to that. I personally don't know the answer to that. There's probably some geologists that can speculate.
Sure.
But we don't actually know the planetary evolution that well of Mars. As an example, we do not know whether it has an active core any longer or not.
Mm.
One of the leading theories of why the atmosphere is so thin is because Mars is smaller, that core cooled quicker, and therefore the dynamo that creates the magnetosphere that protects the Earth, right, from the solar wind, died off earlier. We see remnant magnetism in areas on Mars, but there's no large magneto. So those kinds of evolutionary, planetary evolutionary items are things that we're still trying to learn. So I don't think we really know that.
Excellent. And Scott Rudy, now that monkeys are assisting with long-term effects of space travel, how far off is an actual trip to Mars for humans?
That's an excellent question, too. The hardest part about Mars is getting to the surface.
Mm.
And it has just enough atmosphere that you really have to deal with it. Unlike the Moon, you can ignore what little molecules are there.
Sure.
Mars, however, you can't. So it's not enough to really help you slow down, like bringing Apollos and Geminis back to Earth or the space shuttle back to Earth. But there's enough that you have to worry about it. So the problem here is we don't have the technology to get humans to the surface of the planet. We can get things, the biggest thing that we've ever gotten to the surface, we're going to try to do in 2011, and that's the Mars Science Laboratory. It's going to enter the atmosphere at about 3,000 kilograms.
Okay.
What we're talking about for humans are things on the order of 40,000 kilograms.
Yes.
So we are a long way from knowing how to do that.
Absolutely.
If we put a concentrated effort into it, it would probably take us on the order of 10 to 20 years to develop and test those technologies to prove that we could do it safely. We don't want to burn the astronauts up.
Absolutely.
That'd be tacky.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
Be tacky.
And so Lightbulb has another great question.
Yeah.
Have we found an active volcano anywhere besides Earth in our solar system?
Yeah. We're a little beyond my experience base, but let me address one item. I think we have on Venus, but Venus is very tough to see.
Absolutely.
So I'm not completely positive of that. The one thing that we do have, though, is a geyser.
Yes.
Yes, we have a geyser on Enceladus. Not quite a volcano, but actually maybe more interesting.
Yeah.
It's made up of water, as we would expect, as we foresee water here on this planet. We're used to seeing it. And it's a constant spew into the rings of Saturn as Enceladus makes its way around.
Mm.
It is something that was a complete surprise that Cassini discovered, and actually brings a whole new thought process to the potential for life in the outer solar system, where it's much colder and much darker than Mars.
Absolutely. And, of course, all the other solar systems that we've detected.
Enormous numbers.
Carl Sagan was very fond of the notion of life, you know, everywhere, essentially, potentially.
Potentially.
But, I mean, finding life on a different planet is one of the most amazing, well, it's like the canonical example of what we want to know as humans.
Right.
Are we alone in the universe?
Or right.
Is there only us on this planet?
That's
is this
right.
a totally freakish accident? When, in some sense, and this is a question I would have for you, when you think about life, and you think about life from a planetary perspective, it's hard to separate the surface from the things that live on it.
Right.
And so in some sense, could planets just age and they die? So the Earth will look like Mars, and hopefully not in the near future.
Hopefully not.
Hopefully we'll go 2012.
Yeah.
We'll beat that.
Well,
but could that just be sort of a kind of fractal nature of the universe? And
those are exactly the kinds of questions that we're trying to answer. There's a field called comparative planetology. And frankly, with Mars being as accessible as it is, it's a near neighbor, it's a sister planet.
Absolutely.
And even though it's very difficult to get to the surface, we can do it, unlike Venus or Saturn, right, which is gas giants.
Sure.
And so that comparative planetology and what the life cycle of a planet is something we're trying to understand. Mars provides us, the only data point we have is Earth.
Exactly.
Right? And most of its ancient record is wiped out because of all the biology on the planet.
Absolutely.
So we believe the Moon and Mars preserve that ancient history, and we can learn a lot from Mars as a result.
Excellent. Kind of understand where our solar system came from.
That's right, and where it may be going.
Excellent. So we have Crypto Argonaut. What's Beyond Mars Science Lab for Mars?
Ah, that's a great question. We've got some exciting missions coming. I've already talked about the loss of the atmosphere and the potential magneto that is gone. We have a mission in 2013 that's going to look at exactly that. It's called MAVEN, and it's a field called Aronomy. And what it's going to do is it's going to go measure the atmosphere and try to understand what the current escape rate is of the atmosphere from the gravitational well of Mars.
Interesting.
And through that, and understanding that process, from the surface down to very low altitudes, not all the way to the surface, from the top of the atmosphere down, try to understand, we can extrapolate back what has happened, we hope, in the past with that atmosphere, and make some hypotheses on what the atmosphere used to be like.
Awesome.
After that, we've got a mission I mentioned earlier as well, that is going to go look for the methane that we've detected a couple of years ago and try to understand the other related trace gas species that help us understand the source and of the biogenic or geologic for the methane. Then we're going back to the surface. In 2018, we're going back to the surface, and right now we're looking at a joint mission with the European Space Agency to do that with.
Excellent. So, all right, so Exosphere. What instruments do you plan to bring to Mars, and what will you do if you find life there?
Ah, well, if we find life, I don't have a budget problem anymore. So in that regard, it'd be nice to find it. The instruments that we take, we always take cameras. Anytime you go to the surface, you want to take cameras to understand. You can learn a lot, but it's also a great way to engage the public in what we're doing. But you learn a lot from cameras as well, and understanding the sediments in the rocks and things like the hematite blueberries, that if you don't have a camera, you can't do that. Spectrometers to understand mineral makeup. Meteorology instruments to understand wind speed and pressure and temperature gradients and temperature change. A marriage of those two, a good example, is the Phoenix mission, which was up in the northern Arctic plains. And as winter was setting in last year, we could watch the temperatures change, and we had temperature gradients from the surface up to about 3 meters. We could watch the temperatures change. We had a laser that looked up, and we could actually see snowfall. We saw the first snowfall on another planet come in as winter set in. You can watch frost build up on the ground with the cameras. You can watch the wind speed and wind directions change. We had a meteorology package on. So those are kind of a standard instrument set. And then things like the Mars Science Laboratory and searching for life, you need to look for carbon-based compounds. So things like gas chromatographs and mass spectrometers, analytical chemistry instruments you would typically find in a laboratory on Earth, we are shrinking and packaging and sending to Mars to use on the surface.
Excellent.
So,
and even if you don't find currently existing life on Mars, yet you find what perhaps could be remnants of what was once there.
Right.
That also is going to be one of the greatest discoveries of all time.
Of all time.
I mean, that's a beautiful thing.
If we could find those fingerprints, it would be wonderful.
Totally.
Yeah.
So Joy Chak asks, and this kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier about sending humans to Mars. How long would it take to get a human to Mars?
Humans, robots, takes about the same amount of time.
Humans more comfortable.
Humans more comfortable, okay. Yes. Probably the quickest you can get them there is about 6 months. Typical trip is about 9 months, 8 to 9 months.
Wow.
So it's a long journey. And considering issues we have with astronauts on space stations,
yeah,
just with the bone loss and muscle mass loss and things, it's a difficult thing to get them there and still have them physically functional. It's tough. Not to mention the psychological issues of being isolated like that for an extended period.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and of course, it's not like that we're not doing research and moving faster.
That's right.
Not that we're going to get to the speed of light or fold space.
Right.
But
right.
Obviously, the geniuses at JPL and other places around NASA are thinking also about propulsion systems that could get us there
absolutely
sooner.
NASA has a very vibrant propulsion program, as a matter of fact, looking at those new techniques and technologies.
Excellent.
Absolutely.
So Al L3891, to what extent can the rover repair itself?
Ah.
No Star Wars droids to help out, I suppose.
No. Well, you may know that Spirit actually is, the rover team doesn't like me to state it this way, but it's true. We're stuck in some sand.
Okay.
So very soft. And what I would give to have a droid there to go put a tow cable on it and pull it out, it'd be great. So it actually has very good software repair capabilities.
Sure.
So it has extensive what we call fault protection systems to allow it to understand what its problems are, to a certain extent diagnose it. We like to do the repairs ourselves, so it will tell us what it thinks is wrong. It will give us telemetry data and say, here's all the things that are wrong.
Mm.
But the smarts on it don't allow it to actually figure out how to fix itself at this point in time. And it's a little dangerous. You don't want to lose one. With the kind of financial investments and the ability to get to the surface is so challenging. And once it's there, we want to do this properly and carefully and think it through. So we don't let it do a lot of its own repair. They really don't have much of a capability to repair themselves mechanically.
Sure.
So.
But from, and this carcass, this goes to the next question, from Lightbulb again, who's asking some good questions today. You hear about rebooting spacecraft to fix problems, and we sort of talked about this yesterday with your colleague.
Yeah.
How do you reboot, and what are the risks?
Right. Well, there's warm reboots and cold reboots. It's going to sound just like your PC.
Totally.
and so we have a whole command set the spacecraft recognizes, and it has memory in PROM, right? In PROM that is non-corruptible, so it recognizes certain commands all the time.
Yeah.
And so we tell it to do a warm reboot, or we just send a command to tell it to do a soft reboot, and it'll do it just like your PC. What are the risks? The risks are if you have a hardware failure that you can't detect that caused the reboot,
mm-hmm.
It may not come back up again. So we are very judicious about rebooting if we don't understand the root cause of why it rebooted. Because if you tell it to shut down and reboot, and there's a hardware problem, it may not come back up again. So we do it very carefully.
Perfect. So Offbeat Mammal, what would you like developers, I mean, this is the PDC, what would you like developers to do with the data you've already exposed over Dallas? Right
now? There are a number of really exciting things from a scientific perspective, going back to citizen science. He's a developer. I'll get to that in a second. But I think that's probably the immediate strength of this partnership. I really do. As far as developers are concerned, there may be opportunities for new approaches and new minds coming into autonomous systems for rovers. Because light time is 7 or 8 minutes, when we tell a rover to do something, it doesn't get the command for 7 or 8 minutes.
Sure.
So when it's done it, it's a while later before we find out how it did.
Mm.
So putting autonomy on board those rovers helps a lot. As an example, and he may have spoken about this yesterday, when we first landed Spirit and Opportunity on the surface, they couldn't drive very far at all by themselves. If they saw an issue, they would just stop. There's now some hazard avoidance software aboard that will allow it to build its own paths around medium-sized rocks or recognize rock sizes that it can go over.
Mm.
So we've come a long way. Sounds simple, but then the processing power is pretty rudimentary as well. So I think developers could help us in that regard, and data mining is the other one.
Sure.
Some of these instruments bring such enormous volumes of data down that scientists literally cannot go through it all. It takes years. So data mining techniques to identify features and interesting characteristics of the data is another area developers could really help.
Absolutely. Now let's talk a little bit about the next mission, because you're essentially sending over a lab, you know, like a real lab, basically the size of a Jeep or something.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And in software worlds, like at Microsoft World, and we talk a lot about the power of computation that's close to the data.
Mm-hmm.
So the way I would ask the question is, I'm detecting a bunch of things, I'm roving around the planet, and I get a bunch of data, and then I want to compute over it on-premise,
right,
if you will, to use the marketing. Well, it's not marketing, but to use the term we use here at the PDC.
Yeah.
What's the evolution kind of step look like for the next rover in terms of onboard computation of data, and then send you it, but sort of to filter it close to real time?
Right. The next mission actually isn't going to be a rover that has that capability.
Okay.
The mission in 2016 that's going to look for trace gases, some of the data volume is so high on some of those instruments that we're looking into doing exactly that, to do some data computation on board.
Excellent.
And not send everything back, which is a whole new paradigm for scientists, not to get raw data, because they like to work the raw data.
Sure.
But we just literally can't get it all back, probably, from some of these spectrometers and sounders and things.
Mm.
So we are looking at being able to process some data on board, have the instruments make some decisions on what it ought to send back and what it ought not.
Excellent.
Which is a real step forward from what we've done in the past.
Perfect. So, all right, a Space Invader Zero, binary Space Invader at that. Are there any plans to set up a communication network around Mars that would allow us to have constant contact with surface craft?
Wow. That's a great question, because we actually have a network around Mars currently.
Mm.
So our orbiters actually are dual purpose. We have two orbiters there now, Mars Odyssey and Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. There's another mission called Mars Express, which is European owned. And that's how we get our data back, mainly. About 99% of the data for Spirit and Opportunity, will be true for Mars Science Lab also, actually come through those orbiters.
Mm.
Because they're low altitude, we don't have constant coverage of those. But we do have a couple of passes a day to download the data. So it almost feels like it's real time.
Absolutely. So, I mean, you guys have a lot of data.
An enormous amount.
Just a ton of data. Have you gone through it all? Have you analyzed it this way, that way, the other way?
No.
So there's still a lot of work to do.
There's a lot of work to do. Hence the data mining. I think
Excellent.
If we can get some developers to help us with data mining techniques, that'd be a wonderful place to apply all these programming skills.
Well, I mean, one of the things we talk a lot about at the PDC is parallel computing. And data parallel computing is sort of the easiest parallelism problem, because data is kind of easy to break up, do a bunch of computation, and put back together. Which is different for the general purpose developer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that you could get some really, maybe Burton Smith could come help you guys do some. But you have rocket science developers at NASA. I know you do.
Yeah.
You know,
rocket scientists don't know much about data, though. Let me tell you.
No.
They're all about fuel and big nozzles. That's what they're about. So.
Excellent.
Yep. But we need them too.
Well, rocket scientists are. Light bulb. If you had an unlimited budget, what would you do first? That'll be the last thing in 10 seconds.
10 seconds. That's an easy one. Bring samples back from Mars.
Excellent.
It's the hardest mission in this solar system to accomplish.
So just to bring samples
just
back.
Just to bring them back.
Because you have to get off the surface again.
You got to get there, get down to the surface, pick them up, and get them back. Oh. And it's tough. It's
Excellent.
Really tough.
Hey, amazing to talk to you.
Nice talking with you.
Thank you.
Appreciate the time.
Absolutely.
All right.
And hope to see you again.
Bye-bye.